Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we're going to talk about the CDC's new guidance on double masking. But first, we've been hearing a lot about COVID-19 variants. For viruses, mutations are a natural course of life. But for people, mutations are unsettling unknowns to an already stressful situation. And now comes another wrinkle. Researchers have found something really intriguing in a few specific COVID-19 patients, people who seem to be reservoirs for coronavirus mutations. Here with me to break down this fascinating news is Maggie Kurth, senior science reporter for 538, based in Minneapolis. Welcome back, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do we know about these people who seem to be reservoirs for mutations?
Well, so what we're finding is that these are usually chronic patients. So they're not people who are, you know, those COVID long haulers who have symptoms persisting after an infection passed. These are people whose infections never went away. So one of these patients is a man in the United States who had had an active COVID infection for 154 days before he finally died from it. He was infectious that entire 5 months or so, and the doctors could watch the virus evolve resistance to various treatments over time that he was getting. So it was mutating faster than they had seen SARS-CoV-2 do anywhere else. And by the time he died, it was starting to fight off even things like monoclonal antibody medications.
Wow. I'm hoping this is a really uncommon situation.
I mean, it is both uncommon and not unique, right? Like, this is not something that happens everywhere, but it is something that they have identified in multiple places. You know, around the same time, there was another person in the UK, a man whose illness lasted about 102 days. Before he also died, and doctors found the same sort of hyper-fast mutation happening in COVID in his body. So these cases, there are, you know, more than one, and they're important because they're showing us, you know, where these new easily transmissible and vaccine-resistant variants are likely coming from.
Are they able to track these people or the mutations that are happening in terms of then they're these reservoirs, but the reservoirs then leak out of the patient, and that's where we get some of the new mutations?
That is what some of the speculation is right now. We don't know that for certain, but that seems to be pretty likely because these patients that they have identified do seem to be having mutations in some of the same places as the new variants. So right now, we know that we can identify some of them. But the assumption is that there are probably some people out there who weren't identified as these type of patients. And from there, the mutated versions kind of got out into the world.
Huh. Something new to worry about, but I'm not going to let it keep me up at night more than any of the rest of COVID-19. Okay, let's move on to another COVID-19 story. This one out of South Africa. South Africa has suspended the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine there. Why?
Yeah, that is because it seems to be significantly less effective in that country, down to the point that it no longer clears the hurdle of what effectiveness means to actually be used. So they've been really struggling with vaccine rollouts in South Africa because the COVID variant that has become the dominant variant in that country is one that is resistant to the vaccines, and it's resistant to all of the vaccines that we have to varying degrees. So for instance, in South Africa, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been shown to be about 57% effective against mild and moderate disease, whereas in the US, it's 72% effective. Novavax was even lower than that in South Africa, about 49% effective against mild and moderate disease. But this AstraZeneca situation is even worse than that. So in the first few months of a trial that began in June, researchers were seeing really good results. So AstraZeneca then was getting about 75% effective, which was results on par with other countries. But more recently, as that new variant has spread throughout South Africa, the results dropped to less than 25% effective. And that was when the South African government stopped rolling out AstraZeneca there.
So where is it being used? I know it's not being used here in the US.
Right. It is being used in the UK right now. And there are a couple of other places also. It is kind of a big problem, though, to have this kind of resistance, this level of resistance built up to AstraZeneca, because that was supposed to be the vaccine that would be widely available in developing countries like some of South Africa's neighbors.
But the World Health Organization did just recommend the use of this vaccine, even in places with variants. It seems like there might be conflicting information out there, no?
Well, so this is where it gets complicated, because when we're talking about these studies, what we're usually talking about is effectiveness against mild and moderate disease. So, you know, how many people is the vaccine preventing from getting the sniffles? How many people is the vaccine preventing from having, you know, a couple of bad days at home, right? But the vaccine can be not so great at preventing that, but still pretty good at preventing severe illness and death. And we know that with, for instance, the Johnson & Johnson vaccines in South Africa, they have not been super great at preventing mild and moderate disease, but still been nearly 100% effective at preventing severe illness and death. So we don't have the answers for that around AstraZeneca yet, because the trial of it was small and mostly involved young, healthy people. But there is reason to assume that it would also still have effectiveness against the most severe disease.
Yeah, and that seems to be the good news with the other vaccines, is that they may not be most effective at the top level, but they're effective enough that they keep you from dying from it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It kind of comes down to, like, what are you most concerned about preventing?
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that on last week's show, we had a whole segment about the new COVID-19 variants and how effective our vaccines are against them. And you can go back and listen to our show on our website, sciencefriday.com/variants. Let's move on to some epidemiological news. New information about why some places in the U.S. have Lyme-carrying ticks but don't have Lyme disease.
This is super interesting. So I did not actually realize this until the study came out. They're black-legged tick that lives all over this country. But the Lyme disease that it can carry only really has a significant impact on humans in the Northeast and more recently in north central parts of the U.S. And why some parts of the country have, you know, ticks that can carry Lyme but not Lyme disease has been this huge mystery. And scientists may have figured out part of what's going on here now. That's because some researchers spent 2 years just studying the heck out of ticks. They looked at how they lived, they looked at where they lived, they looked at what kinds of hosts they were sucking, and they basically found, like, this clear line south of Virginia where the ticks are just different.
What you mean, the ticks are different, or where the Lyme disease is being carried by perhaps different creatures?
A little bit of both. So in the Northeast, you have these ticks that have these behaviors, like climbing up trees and bushes to look for hosts. And they also have a favorite meal in the little white-footed mouse. Whereas in the South, the ticks prefer to dine on lizards, and they stay down in the underbrush on the forest floor where those lizards are most likely to be. And both of those differences have a big impact on how much access the ticks have to people and on how likely they are to get the Lyme bacteria themselves. Mice are really good at transmitting it. Lizards, not so much.
That's interesting, very interesting, because Lyme disease can be really devastating. Could this new research cue us into the future of this illness, perhaps, and how it spreads?
I think what it does is sort of direct our attention to how the environment affects the transmission of this disease, because we know that climate change is already altering the patterns of Lyme disease in this country. You know, we've already seen those northeastern ticks expanding their range into the upper Midwest and bringing those behaviors and Lyme disease with them. So any change to climate is likely to change things like how ticks live and what they're eating.
Yeah. I want to go into a story that is kind of really cute, I want to say, because it's really fun. It turns out some rocks have been trying to dupe us into thinking they're fossils.
Yes. So,
oh, there go those rocks again.
Oh, those rocks. You know, it is really awesome when you get these rocks that have evidence of really ancient life, you know, things like fossilized bacteria, single-celled organisms in rocks. But it turns out that some of those fossils, and maybe even most of them, might not actually be fossils at all. These scientists did an experiment in their laboratory where they replicated the process of making a type of rock called chert. And they had bacteria in some of this, and they had no bacteria in others. And what they found was that as that rock solidified, it flattened and deformed the bacteria to the point that you couldn't even tell what that had been. But meanwhile, these squiggly crystal structures that were not alive, but were very easily mistaken for bacteria, kept their shape. So they came through the process ready to be misidentified as doomed fossil brethren. And it is a problem that scientists were aware of already, but they hadn't really known how serious the problem was. And that's going to have an impact on how we interpret, you know, not just rocks found here on Earth, but also any that we bring back from Mars.
You know, that's exactly what I was going to say, because in the back of my mind, I remember a story of Martian rocks that were found here on Earth. And they were looking at these little squiggly round knobs on them and thinking, hey, these are fossilized remnants of microbacteria that might once have grown on Mars. And there was a big news story about it.
Yes.
Remember that? So this is what you're talking about, I guess.
This is exactly the kind of thing we're talking about. And it is going to take a lot of work, I think, for scientists to figure out if there's any way to tell which is the actual bacteria and which is just sneaky, sneaky rocks going around looking like bacteria.
Oh, those rocks. They'll do it every time. Thank you, Maggie.
Yeah, thank you.
Maggie Kurth, senior science reporter for 538 based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're unmasking the science behind masks. What does double masking do? How does a mask trap a virus? Stay with us to find out.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Throughout the pandemic, masks have been a big issue, right? First came a mask shortage, then debates about statewide mask mandates, and then finally refusal by some people to wear them. Well, this week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put out another wrinkle, guidance on double masking, wearing one mask over another. So, what is the science behind masks and how they work? Like, what does a double mask really do? How does a mask trap a virus? Is there an expiration date to a mask? I think we've all wondered these. So here with the answers is Dr. Lindsay Marr, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You must get asked these questions all the time.
I have been asked these questions hundreds, if not thousands of times in the past year.
Good. So you're well-versed to answer ours when we ask them. Okay. So let's talk about the new CDC recommendations for double masking. Does wearing two masks double the filtration, or how does that work?
The way it works is that the CDC recommendation for double masking is actually getting at two different properties that are really important for a mask's performance. The first is filtration, the ability of a mask to filter out small particles, or we sometimes call them aerosols. And the second part is the fit of the mask, because you can have the best filtration in the world, like an N95, but if it doesn't fit, if it leaks around the edges, it's like you have big holes in your mask.
And so the second mask is then sort of helping to push the first one against your face better, making a better seal?
Exactly. The type of double masking that is recommended by CDC now that they found works really well is to use a surgical type of mask, also called a procedure mask, preferably one that's ASTM certified, because those have been proven to filter out particles well. So you put that on the bottom, but it's a rectangle. It doesn't really fit well to our faces and inevitably has gaps around the cheeks. So if you put a second mask, a tight-fitting cloth mask on top of that, you can greatly improve the fit, reduce leaks, and you add another layer of filtration.
Now, masks can be made of all different types of materials. What are the basics of how a mask traps a virus?
One common misconception is that masks work by sieving out particles that are larger than the holes in the mask, like straining pasta, for example. But in reality, filtration works in a very different way. The mask itself, the fabric or the polypropylene fibers that are used to make an N95 or surgical mask, are essentially this obstacle course that the air has to flow around. So if you shrink yourself down to the size of one of those individual fibers, you are twisting and turning in the air as you're trying to navigate through this maze of fibers. As you do that, any particles or aerosols that are in the air may not be able to make all those twists and turns and may end up crashing into one of the fibers and being filtered out.
What makes an N95 mask so much better than another kind of mask?
N95s are really effective for a couple of reasons. First, they're made out of a special type of material called melt-blown non-woven polypropylene. And these are very, very small fibers that are then pressed together, and they have very small spaces in between them. The second thing that an N95 has is an electrostatic charge, kind of like rubbing a balloon against your hair and then your hair sticks to it. They apply a charge to the N95, and then it is better able to capture particles that are naturally charged that are kind of coming towards it and trying to get through there. So this electrostatic charge attracts the particles to the N95 and acts as an additional way to trap the particles in there.
Is it harder with this double masking idea to actually breathe through the mask? And is that a possible problem for people who say, you know, I'm just not going to wear these double masks because I can't breathe through them?
Absolutely. This is a concern. One of the most important things with your mask is that you can easily breathe through it, because if you can't, it's going to be uncomfortable and you won't want to wear it. And secondly, if it's too thick or too hard to breathe through, then it's more likely that air is going to leak in through the sides. It wants to find it the easiest way in. And so certainly if double masking makes it too hard to breathe, then you need to look for another solution.
And where would you look for that? How do you shop for a mask?
There's a couple of things to look for in a mask. There's the basic cloth masks, and those work okay. They might filter out 50% of particles on average. But you should actually look for a mask that has a dedicated layer of filtration material. And that could be a surgical type mask, or they'll say a polypropylene filter. I've seen things that have HEPA filters, which stands for high efficiency particulate air filtration. Those are very effective too. We have found that vacuum cleaner bags work well, and certain types of HVAC filters. So you definitely should look for some kind of filtering layer in your mask. You also want something that fits well, and people's faces are such different shapes that this is somewhat of a personal preference thing. But also, it's really important to have one of those metal nose bridges that you can bend to fit closely around your nose, because that's a place where it's easy to have a lot of leakage. And also, the ear loops are okay, but if you want an even tighter fit, if you get something that secures, fastens around your head, that's even better.
Let me get back to the vacuum cleaner bag for a second, because I don't think people are going to put that over their head or their mouth, are they?
Absolutely not. We don't recommend that you put a vacuum cleaner bag or these other filter materials directly against your face. Rather, you would want to sandwich them in between two layers of some other fabric that's more comfortable. And this is actually how an N95 is made. The filtration layer is kind of sandwiched in between some other layers.
I've had masks that are double layers, and then they also have a pocket in them that you can slip a coffee filter, or now I guess I could cut up a vacuum cleaner filter and put it in there. Is that a good technique?
Yes, absolutely. If you have a cloth mask that has a pocket in it and you insert some kind of filter material, I think months ago, a coffee filter was certainly okay, better than nothing. But now that we have these new, more easily transmissible variants, we need to focus on improving the quality and performance of that filter that we're putting in there. So something like a HEPA filter. I, for example, went to my local big box store and bought a HEPA filter that's made for air purifiers, and I kind of cut it out of the frame and pulled it apart and have cut pieces to put into my mask. I think you can buy these already pre-cut in some places online, I've seen. So certainly this is the time to be thinking about upgrading our filters in our masks.
Now, a couple of things about the viruses and the interaction with the masks. A mask, as you say, traps all of these virus particles but doesn't kill the viruses. So are we wearing basically a biohazard on our face?
That's one extreme way of putting it. Yes, viruses can, of course, be trapped on, they will be trapped on your mask. They can survive for some time, although they tend not to survive very long on porous, fabric-y types of materials. On the more plasticky type of materials like surgical masks and N95s, they might survive longer. Sunlight kills them off fairly quickly within an hour. But that said, you should always handle your mask carefully as if it is contaminated, because it might be. And so you can put it on and take it off just using the straps and avoid touching the front of it.
If you just let it hang out for a while, I mean, would a day or two kill the viruses on the mask?
Yes, absolutely. Letting it just sit aside for a day undisturbed, those viruses will decay away or die off.
When you're wearing a mask for a while, there is this moisture that can build up in the mask from your breath. Does a wet mask affect the efficacy, the efficiency of the mask, how well it filters?
That's a great question. There haven't been a lot of studies on that. I think it will still work. Whether it works as well or perhaps better is going to depend on the type of material it's made out of, if it absorbs water and swells up, and how much water there is. That said, generally, we recommend that if your mask does get wet, it's time to switch to a new one.
So you should not be throwing your mask into the washing machine.
Cloth masks can go into the washing machine, and you probably want to do that, just like your dirty socks. But the filtering layers are sometimes, because that some of them have this electrostatic charge, you don't want to get those wet. And so that's why the cloth masks sometimes have those pockets, so you can take that filtering layer out, wash the mask, and then put the filtering layer back in.
Does a mask have an expiration to it? I mean, how many times can you wear it before you need to throw it out?
That's a good question. Again, with N95s and surgical masks that are made out of this melt-blown, non-woven polypropylene, that material is really tough, and it's going to outlast any other part of the mask, like the straps. The straps will go first. That said, if you do see dirt or soiling or any kind of wear and tear on those types of masks, it's time to dispose of them and get a new one. We've tested masks, N95s, for reuse in healthcare settings for really up to 10 sterilization cycles, meaning that the healthcare workers are wearing them for 10 days over, I assume, 8 hours per day.
So you can overload a mask after a number of uses.
It's possible, certainly, that the mask could get, if you're in a really dusty environment, that the mask could get kind of soiled and clogged and won't work as well. So then certainly it's time to switch to a new mask.
I've seen some masks that come with a carbon filter inside of them. Is this legitimate?
Those filters, you know, I've been meaning to test those in the laboratory because I haven't seen any results on those yet. So in theory, if they are designed to filter out PM2.5, which is 2.5 microns and smaller, they should work well for the virus. I don't know how well. My concern about those is that the ones I've seen are small, so they're not fitting entirely, filling up the entire area of your mask, so air is going to leak in around the sides, and that they're a little stiff, which is going to degrade the fit of your mask.
If you want to start over and start making the best mask that you can now, how should you do that?
There's a couple of different options. One is to look for a good cloth mask that fits your face well and has a pocket where you can put a filter into. That could be just the surgical type of material. The double masking recommendation from the CDC will work well. Kind of a single layer cloth mask, if that's what you're still using, then it's time to think about upgrading that.
Now, I know that you study ventilation, which is one of my favorite topics, believe it or not. I mean, is it possible to really make a space equivalent to outdoors in terms of ventilation and movement of air? And would that solve a lot of problems we're having with mask wearing also?
Good ventilation is essential for reducing the risk of transmission of COVID-19 because the virus is in the air and it builds up just like and behaves and can build up just like cigarette smoke. And it's surprisingly easy to get good ventilation in a room if you have windows and doors, really just to open those even just part way. And it's surprising actually how much of a difference that can make.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. I'm trying to figure out what a mask laboratory looks like. Give me an idea of how you go about testing masks. I'm thinking of like Consumer Reports with all kinds of different materials in them.
There are a couple of different ways we test masks. One is to look at just the material itself. And so we cut out little circles of the material, a few inches in diameter, and we put that into a holder, kind of a cylindrical holder. And then we put that into a chamber, which is really just like a big bag that's sitting on top of our counter. And we fill that bag with sodium chloride particles, that's salt solution particles from a medical nebulizer, the type that people might use at home to administer medication. And then what we do is we set up our equipment to measure kind of what will pull air through that material, through the filter, through the mask material, and measure how many particles come through compared to how many are actually inside that chamber. That's one way we can measure the efficacy of a mask. The other way is to do it in a more realistic way where we put the mask onto some mannequins. We have these foam heads in our lab and we cored out the mouth of these heads and we put either a nebulizer into one of them to generate these particles coming out of one. And the other one, we run a tube through and we connect that to our instruments to measure how many particles get in.
Is there such a thing as an ideal mask? When you study things in science or engineering, you have the ideal fluid, the ideal whatever. Is there an ideal mask that you're shooting for? And is it possible to make that?
I think the ideal mask would be 100% effective at filtering out particles. You know, N95s are 95% effective. It would be easy to breathe through, and it would be very comfortable to wear for long periods of time. That's a challenge because usually if it's better at filtering out particles, it becomes harder to breathe through. So we have to strike a balance.
So the bottom line again on this is if you're going to make your own mask, buy your own mask, or shape your own mask, you start out with what and end up with what?
Start out with a tightly woven cotton material for the outer layers of your mask. Have a pocket in the mask into which you can insert a good filter material. The mask should have a metal nose bridge that you bend carefully to fit around your nose and eliminate leaks. If you have straps that can tighten around your head, you'll get a tighter fit compared to ones that go around your ears, and it should be fashionable.
fashionable. You know, that really makes sense, because then if we make fashions out of the mask, more people will wear them than won't wear them.
Absolutely. We should make it cool to wear masks and get creative with them.
And how young a kid should start wearing a mask?
CDC recommends kids as young as 2, but not younger than that, because it can be a choking hazard.
All right. I think you have done it. You have answered everything there is to know about masks for us.
Well, I've certainly tried. Masks, though, are not 100% effective, so it's important to also practice distancing, ensuring good ventilation, avoiding crowds, and washing our hands.
There you go. Thank you very much, Dr. Marr.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Lindsay Marr, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, looking ahead to a landing on Mars, the Perseverance rover scheduled to touch down next week, and it has a helicopter on board. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Next week, the Mars 2020 mission arrives at its destination, and if all goes as planned, the Perseverance rover will land on the red planet next Thursday. Joining me now for a look ahead to the new rover mission and what it's planning to do is Lori Glaze. She's director of NASA's Science Mission Directorate's Planetary Science Division in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Glaze.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Could you sum up for us this mission? What's the main mission here?
The key objectives of this mission, it's a lander that's going to land in a place called Jezero Crater on Mars, and it's actually going to rove around. This will be our 5th rover on the surface of Mars. And the primary objective is to understand the geology in that location, understanding the geologic history of Jezero Crater, but also really looking at the astrobiology history at that location, where astrobiology is the science of understanding what types of environments can support life, and actually looking for potential chemical markers of early microbes that may have existed 3.5 billion years ago. And then the third major objective is to collect samples of rocks and soils and store them on the surface for eventual return back to Earth. And then finally, it also has a goal to help us better prepare for eventual future human exploration of Mars.
So let's see if we can unpack some of this, because there are a lot of interesting mission objectives here. The landing site, is there something special about this site that would help you accomplish what you want to do there?
Yes, there is something special. So we are landing in Jezero Crater. There were lots of potential great landing sites on Mars with lots of great science questions that could be answered. But this particular landing site was intriguing because we can tell by looking at orbital images of the surface of Mars and looking at Jezero Crater that there was a river that once flowed into this crater, and that there must have been a standing body of water that persisted for a very, very long time, because we can see that as that river flowed into the standing body of water, that it dropped sediments onto the ground, onto the floor of the lake, and created a river delta right in there inside the crater. And we also know that that crater and this river delta system would have been active about 3.5 billion years ago. That's about the time that life was starting to form on Earth. And we know that Mars was much warmer and wetter, as evidenced by the rivers and lake, and that had life started to form on Mars at that same time, this would be exactly the kind of deposit that would preserve those really early microbiologic fossils in the river delta. In addition, because it's a river delta, the river would have been picking up sediment from a huge catchment area and then delivering it all into this more or less confined spot right in Jezero Crater. So as we're thinking about trying to address questions about the early evolution of Mars and understanding whether or not life ever existed on Mars, this is the ideal place, or one of the most ideal places on Mars that we can visit.
So this would have been a catch basin for any kinds of life forms that once lived there.
Exactly so.
What kinds of experiments do you have on board?
Several of the instruments are really designed for this understanding the geology and the astrobiology history. We have Sherlock, which is an instrument to help us better understand the organic chemistry that's present. We also have Pixel, which is an X-ray instrument that also is looking at chemistry of the surface. And then we also have another instrument called SuperCam, which is, again, another remote instrument that shoots rocks with a laser to help us better understand what chemistry is present. So those three instruments as a package are doing a lot of work trying to understand the chemistry and mineralogy of the rocks. We have another instrument called RIMFAX, it's a ground penetrating radar, to understand the structure of the crust just beneath the rover. We also are carrying a whole bunch of camera systems that are going to be able to do panoramic images and stereo images for context to help us both with navigation, but also to understand what we're looking at. We have a meteorological station that will be taking regular measurements of temperatures and pressures and winds on the surface. We actually have microphones that will help us hear what's happening on the surface of Mars for the first time. And then we also are carrying a really cool experiment called MOXIE, which is a technology demonstration to actually convert the carbon dioxide of Mars's atmosphere and convert that into breathable oxygen. And this is an experiment that's being sponsored by Human Exploration to help us better prepare to explore Mars with humans and take advantage of the resources that can be found there in situ.
Will Perseverance be able to look at a rock sample and say, hey, this has a greater chance of having life? Let me pick that one up versus the one next to it.
The Perseverance rover has a fantastic suite of really amazing instruments that will be able to look at the rocks and tell us what the chemistry of those rocks is, what the minerals are that are present in those rocks. And we'll be looking for those kind of chemical markers, molecules and minerals that contain carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, those key building blocks to life. Answering the question of whether or not life is there or was there in the past, doing that remotely is very, very challenging. So that's why those instruments will help us identify, as you said, the right samples that we really want to drill and store for return back to Earth.
How will those samples the rover collects make the return trip to Earth?
That is a great question, and one that we are really excited that we are starting to embark on right now is the Mars sample return mission. This is a really complex endeavor and one that we are not going to take alone as NASA. We're actually partnering very closely with the European Space Agency in our early development and planning for Mars sample return. We just started what we call Phase A, which is the very beginnings of those plannings. We're working towards a launch in 2026. And what that mission will look like will actually include two launches from Earth, a NASA launch, which would carry a sample return lander to the surface of Mars. And that lander would carry a fetch rover that would drive out and collect the samples that Perseverance has picked special locations to drop a bunch of the sample tubes at these caching locations. So the fetch rover would go to those specific locations and pick up those tubes at maybe several of those cache depots, and then carry them back to the sample return lander, load them into a return capsule that's then launched from the surface of Mars on the Mars Ascent Vehicle, and place that capsule into orbit around Mars. The European launch, meantime, has sent an orbiter that is in orbit around Mars and will rendezvous with that sample container and capture that sample container to bring it back to Earth.
Wow, sounds like a terrific idea, a very complex mission. Let's talk about a test helicopter that you have on board, something totally different.
It is totally different. This helicopter will be the first ever powered flight on another world. And we are really, really excited about this technology demonstration. It's not something that's required for Perseverance's success, but it is a truly enabling technology that if we can demonstrate the ability to have powered controlled flight on Mars, this would change the way that we are able to explore the surface of Mars. So it is a helicopter. a rotorcraft, very small, and it will be demonstrated in the first few months while we're on the surface of Mars.
And does it look like a helicopter we might see right here on Earth?
It kind of looks like a small drone. It's a little box. It's got two pairs of rotating rotors. It's got four little legs on it that help it to land gently. I think it would be recognizable as a helicopter.
Yeah. How does Perseverance fit into the big picture of other Mars missions? You've had Curiosity, Insight. We've had a succession of very successful missions. How does that complete what they've done?
So Perseverance really is the culmination of what we've learned with all of our exploring to date. You know, every mission that we send to Mars answers questions, but asks new questions. And we keep building on what we've learned on each one of those missions. So in the earliest times, we sent Viking, of course, to the surface of Mars. In a sense, it was designed, we thought, to look for signs of life. But as we look back on that experiment now, those experiments that were held on Viking, we didn't know enough about what we didn't know. Even if life had been there, those experiments probably would not have been successful. But then we learned from that, and we learned about the need to really understand the environments where we were going so that we could design the right experiments. Spirit and Opportunity rovers were able to identify and conclude that there was actually some water present in the past. It wasn't clear whether that water was really the right acidic or pH level to support kind of life as we know it. But then we sent the Phoenix lander, which actually found water ice on the surface of Mars, confirming that there is water ice present on Mars. And then the Curiosity rover in Gale Crater was able to confirm that not only was there standing water for a persistent time in Gale Crater, but that water was a pH level that could support life. And then Curiosity also found these complex organic molecules, another building block for life. And so each of those helped us to better understand what kind of environments we need to be looking for and how to design our experiments. And one of the big lessons learned there is that really bringing the samples back to Earth is the key piece that we need to really understand what we're seeing in the rocks on Mars. And so that's one of the fundamental elements of Perseverance.
You know, you meaning NASA, has had such great success with the longevity of its rovers. What, the first rovers were supposed to last 90 days and then decades later, still working? What is the life expectancy of this one?
That's a really great question. And you're right. I mean, the Spirit and Opportunity rovers were, oh my goodness, the Energizer bunnies. They just wouldn't stop going. And then finally, of course, Opportunity was overcome by a dust storm, by all things. You know, it was still going, the rover was still going strong, but the dust storm finally took it out. We couldn't recharge the batteries with the solar arrays any longer. Now, Curiosity is still going strong as well, but both Curiosity and the Perseverance rover have different power systems than those early Spirit and Opportunity rovers. Spirit and Opportunity had solar arrays that powered them, required the sun. Curiosity and Perseverance, of course, have nuclear power sources, which means we're not susceptible to dust storms impacting our power, which is great. But the downside of that, of course, is that a nuclear power source does have a limited lifetime. Eventually, the nuclear source will decay sufficiently that we won't have enough power to do our work. But as we've seen with Curiosity, it's already been on the surface of Mars, what I think about 8 years now, and still going strong, and expect it to continue going strong for a few more years. And we expect Perseverance to have a similar lifetime capability. The primary mission is just one Mars year, which is two Earth years, but we fully expect it to be operational well beyond that.
Just a quick reminder, this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Lori Glaze, Director of the Planetary Science Division in NASA's Science Mission Directorate, talking with her about the upcoming lander of the Perseverance rover on Mars. What should we expect to see next week? How will the landing take place? Walk us through the sequence.
Okay. The landing is an incredibly exciting experience. It puts you on pins and needles. It's often called the 7 minutes of terror because landing on Mars is really a complex operation where the spacecraft comes in well over 10,000 miles an hour as it hits the top of the atmosphere. And then within 7 minutes, it needs to completely autonomously slow down and land softly on the surface. And that sequence this time is really going to demonstrate a couple of new things, a couple of new technologies that are enabling us to actually even land in JESRO. JESRO is a much smaller target than we've ever tried to hit before. And so as we come into the top of the atmosphere and then we take a look and identify where we are, and that helps us to pinpoint exactly the timing of that parachute release to help us begin that vertical drop in the right location. And then as we get closer to the surface, we have what we call terrain relative navigation, which is an imaging system taking images of the surface and in real time comparing those against maps that we have that identify the safer places to go and the riskier places to go. And as we're coming down, can quickly identify what's the safest place within our reach to land and then maneuver over to that location before the sky crane lowers the lander down to the surface. So a really exciting chain of events. Really encourage folks to watch it. This is a step up from what we did with Curiosity, but we learned a lot from Curiosity, and we think we're definitely prepared.
I didn't really realize there was something different going on in the sky crane part of this.
Yeah, we could not have landed in JESRO with Curiosity. The landing ellipse was too large. But there was so much exciting science that the engineers put their thinking caps on and came up with these really clever additional technologies that we can allow us to pinpoint our landing, which is actually another feed forward to human exploration.
And this is, you say this is going to be a very busy time, but it's also, there are missions from the United Arab Emirates and China arriving around the same time. Nothing like this has ever happened before.
That is correct. This has never happened before. We do have, of course, partners already in orbit at Mars with the European Space Agency and Indian Space Research Organization have orbiters at Mars. But this will be, I think, the first time that we have three different countries arriving at Mars almost at the same time. We all launched back in the summer and we're all arriving approximately the same time in February. Yes, United Arab Emirates arriving on February 9th, and then closely followed by China with their orbiter arriving on February 10th. And then Perseverance arriving on the 18th. It's really, I think it's an amazing time for Mars science to have this much interest and this much international participation in the global science.
Well, we all wish you great luck, everybody who's involved in the project and everybody, you know, in the world watching this. Thank you, Dr. Glaze, for taking time to be with us today.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Lori Glaze, Director of NASA's Science Mission Directorate's Planetary Science Division in Washington, D.C. And that's about all the time we have for this hour. Charles Berquist is our director. Our producers are Christy Taylor, Katie Feather, and Kathleen Davis. Senior producer is Alexa Lim. Contributing producer, John Dankosky. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. And of course, if you missed any part of the program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. And on the Science Friday Vox Pop app this week, Dr. Anthony Fauci is going to be on our show next week. What questions do you have for him? Send us your questions for Dr. Fauci. That's on the Science Friday Vox Pop app, wherever you get your apps. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow.